OWC Radio number 46. I've got a guy named Steve Eisen for the entire show. Check it out. And we are back here on OWC Radio, and I do have a special guest this week. His name is Steve Eisen. Hello, Steve.
Hi there.
Eisen, any relation to Rich?
Absolutely no relation.
None.
Just the name. Unless there's some way beyond in history, but I haven't traced it back. So.
That's the only, for those who don't know, Rich Eisen is an NFL commentator. Steve Eisen, no relation, is our guest here on OWC Radio, but you are also behind the camera at EisenVideo.com. So what do you do, Steve? What's your gig?
Wow, I do a whole lot of stuff.
Renaissance man.
In addition to just shooting and editing, I am a big production guru, technical guru. My background goes back to broadcast news, where I started as a night editor.
Oh, really? So local broadcast news?
Exactly. So started in Peoria, Illinois.
Well, you got to tell me how you got that job. How did that come about?
How did that come about? I was still in college, and I was hoping to get an internship, because that's how you get your foot in the door, is
absolutely.
Internships. So I approached the news director, and you know, it's like, you know, I want an internship at your TV station. He's like, all right, I'll see what we can do. And so I went back to the college professor and the people in charge. So they're like, well, Steve, your GPA isn't high enough, so you know, we can't give you an internship. But then the good news that I got from the news director is we have a weekend opening as an editor. So instead of doing a volunteer internship, I got a paid job.
Wait a minute. So you actually made money because your grades weren't good enough.
Exactly. And that's what I never understood with the whole, workforce over there. You know, like in college, everything's based on GPA and this and that. And, you know, they don't care what experience you have.
No.
But if you have those grades, yeah, well, you know, we'll throw you in with the rest of the people. So
I mean, the grades are important. Let's not gloss exactly. over that. I'm a father of four, so grades are important, kids.
Right.
But by the same token, that experience is worth a lot more in the real world.
Definitely. And, you know, I mean, sure, there's some smart people out there that can, you know, really excel. And but I'll give you a good example from the same college that I went to. A former CEO of a big Fortune 500 company, and you know, he said, I may not be the smartest one out there, but you know, I'm definitely the most wisest, and it just says, you know, you may not be smart, but yet you could still achieve what you wanted to, you know, if you really put your mind to it. So
you went to school to get into broadcasting?
Originally, my major was theater, musical theater. So it came to my senses when I realized that, you know, it's...
No money?
Definitely. There's, you're going to be waiting tables or doing something else versus the, you know, acting in a play or being on TV or in the movie.
So maybe I should let my oldest daughter, who's taking those type of classes right now in college, listen to this episode. Honey.
Exactly. Yes.
Have a fallback plan.
Yeah. Definitely have a fallback plan where, I'll admit I'm talented. I still have my musical voice, which, you know, Broadway came calling, you know, I'd still go for it, but I said I couldn't do it full time.
Yeah.
Definitely could not make a living full time.
And it's hard to do it on a part time basis when there's so many people that want to do it full time.
That's exactly it. There's in different careers, there's a lot more opportunities out there than done professional theater and movies and all that stuff.
So when you go from that to what you ended up doing, what's that path in college at the time? What was it called?
What do you mean the path?
Well, you went from the theater classes to one for production. I mean,
right. It was at that time it was called mass communication.
Gotcha.
So you had a couple different areas to study. You could go into the newspaper part. You could go into radio, television, which I did, and then. And then, like with the newspaper, it was more magazine, print, exactly, which I really didn't have those writing skills. But I did have the technical and the broadcast skills. And so in the radio TV, you had two different options. You had the broadcasting, which was on air, and then you had the production, which was, obviously the editing and the shooting and stuff like that. And I did radio broadcasting and television production. So those were my two big stints. And I got a lot of hands-on experience there. So, and it helped me, obviously, with my first job and led to where I'm at today.
So when you graduate, you've already got experience in working in the industry. How important was that for you as a young man to kind of pursue your goals? Or did you stay at that radio, television station after you graduated?
I stayed for about a year and a half. And since it was Peoria, Illinois, it's a smaller market.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born and raised in Chicago, which is the number three market. But that's where I wanted to end up. I wanted to end up in Chicago. It's, obviously a larger city and a lot more opportunities there. And so, literally pounded the pavement and through a friend of a friend of a friend, got an interview with a cable station, which was, like you see Wayne's World and that's,
right.
That's what it is, cable access. And so, got a job. Literally 70 miles from my house. So, traveled the 70 miles 3-4 times a week.
And that was in the Chicago area?
It was in the Chicago area.
So it's 70 miles is like 2 hours.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely, a good hike.
It's called paying your dues, I think.
Exactly. So I was paying my dues. I was working a sales job at retail store, an electronics store for 3 days a week, and then at the cable station, like 4 days a week. So I was, definitely working 7 days a week and, making money, but putting in a lot of hours and getting myself out. And that's what I had to do, to survive. So, at the time, I didn't have I wasn't full time into production, but that's what I wanted to do. And then did that for a few years. And then I get a call out of the blue from a production company in the Chicago area that said, we're looking for an editor, and went to the interview, and I'm like, we don't need phone calls to disrupt me. So anyway,
how did they find you? I mean, this is pre-internet. It's not like they could just go on Monster.com or Indeed.com and find your resume and get a hold of you.
Exactly. No, it must have been because I know when I was out there, I sent out a million different resumes. Mm-hmm. And I made cold calls to different production companies and, everybody. And this was the early 90s. And we had the Gulf War and all that. And, people were doing hiring freezes and all that. And, so the economy wasn't that great.
But at the same time, cable news was kind of exploding.
It was exploding, yeah. CNN really
changed everything.
And that was part of the job that I was, how I got the job at the cable station was through a guy who wanted to start like a CNN in Chicago. And this was through the Fox station and it never really took off, but then at the same time, the Tribune Company started a 24-hour cable news network within, a couple of years of that. So that leads, while I was, I said I interviewed at this production company, and it's like, okay, it's another interview, this and that, and they called, and it's like offered me like $25,000 a year, and I'm like, holy cow, this is great, and
I could quit my other job now.
Exactly. So it's basically what I did. Quit the job, and this was full time, and Monday through Friday. Don't have to work on the weekends and all that, and for a change. And so that was great. And
life changing.
And then when that 24-hour network opened in Chicago, their headquarters just happened to be right next door to the to where I was working. The only problem is their starting pay was $18,000. So I wasn't gonna go back in salary and do more, work on the weekends, do all that other stuff.
No, that's a step backwards.
Yeah, total step backwards. So with this production company, we did a lot of medical videos, and a lot of it was radiological. So we looked at tons of CAT scans, MRIs, all that stuff. And
super fun.
And it was, for me, I was always interested in the medical field. So I always had an interest in that. So, in addition to me, doing the production skills, I learned, a little more of the medical stuff and, got more knowledge of that. And what wound up happening with that job, the production company lost a couple clients and wasn't making a whole lot of money. So one day at work, boss came by and he's like, whatever I tell you later on, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. So at the end of the day, he called all the employees into his office, and we knew things weren't good when we were all sitting there.
Yeah.
And he's like, guys, I'm going to have to fire everyone, this and that. For the last couple months, I've been, I haven't taken a paycheck because, we're not making the bills and this and that. So that was our heed and warning. Although there was tons of work to do, he literally left two employees at the company. So so onward and, to my next journey. So
do you know why they were doing so poorly? Because I would think that
it was a lot of it was because they only had three or four big clients that was supporting the company, and that was it. Nothing to fall back on. No, trying to pick up little jobs here and there. And I'll admit, back then equipment wasn't cheap.
No, it wasn't.
It was very, very expensive to. To run a production company. And, nowadays it's like a kid out of college can afford a computer and software and all that. If they only knew the cost, the expenses, and, nonlinear was just starting.
Oh, nowadays that you could start your own production company for the cost of a camera.
Exactly.
In the 90s. I mean, it's exactly. Not even close.
Yeah, I mean the video camera we had was $15,000. We had at the time we had linear edit systems based on 3/4 inch, and one of the edit systems was $65,000, and then they were one of the first production companies to get that. They bought a video toaster. The flyer system. So and the hard drives alone, four gigabyte, I think it was is that right? Yeah, 4 gigabyte hard drive was $3,000.
Crazy.
Outrageous. So at least it wasn't my money. So as you can see, they purchased all this equipment, and obviously if you don't have the money coming in, you can't pay for the stuff. So that's what wound up happening. And then from there, this was 1996, and I worked for a rental house in Chicago, which, you know, there, that was a booming business. A lot of people, you know, instead of buying equipment, they would rent equipment, lease equipment.
Sure. I remember when those kind of businesses were popping up all over in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
Right before video became a big thing online and for personal right. use.
Right. So here, this is 1996, and Atlanta, the Olympics were in Atlanta. So definitely, we really, really kept busy during that. And the, and fortunately, with my production skills and hands on in the rental department, we, you know, I built literally huge studios for, you know, all these foreign companies that were at the Olympics in Atlanta. So, you know, because, you know, all the local people had their stuff, but the international people didn't want to bring their equipment.
No, that's too expensive.
Because here, you know, nowadays you take a computer and a hard drive and you're set, where here you needed, you know, everything was tape-based back then.
Yep.
So, you know, you don't want to lug
and
around.
The cameras were so much bigger and heavier, and the tripods.
Exactly.
And all the cables, and it was a nightmare.
Yep.
Even small productions weren't cheap back in the 90s.
No, not at all. So we helped these out, and, you know, from literally from, you know, a small, you know, three-man crew to, you know, full production studios that, you know, did multi-camera and, you know, large switchers and stuff like that. So that was very successful. Then obviously after the Olympics, after they were over, we did have the Democratic Convention. So so July, August, it was great. And then, you know, it was, you know, nothing going on after that. So then literally they fired me after that. And so, you know, here I am again, unemployed, and
through no fault of your own.
Through no fault of my own, and, you know, just that's the way the economy is. It's
absolutely,
you know, even today. It's like you know, if there's not a need, you know, they'll, you know, they're gonna cut you because, you know, someone's gonna. That's how they save money.
But here's the thing about that, and, you know, I hear people online, Facebook friends, when the economy's downturn and they get let go. You know, occasionally people do get fired for fault. Let's not kid
sure.
ourselves.
Oh, definitely.
But the people who are really skilled at what they do always land on their feet.
Exactly.
The really smart people always land on their feet.
That's exactly it. You know,
and what I tell people, I go, I don't care what the economy is, the best plumber you know is always busy.
Exactly.
You know, the best contractors you know are always busy.
That's exactly it. So, so sure enough, I got fired and, you know, went on to my next venture, which was with a cousin who had an entertainment company in the Chicago area, and his bread and butter was doing bar mitzvahs in the Chicago area, I'll say the North Shore,
okay,
just the northern suburbs. And so you know, video was new back then,
so you would go to these events and you would do the filming and the editing.
Exactly.
And they
exactly.
wanted it on VHS and maybe
yeah.
DVD eventually.
Yeah, DVD was like so unheard
that's,
of back then.
Yeah, that's the hotness.
It wasn't, you know, like I think DVD came in like maybe 2000. Is that right or so? Like,
yeah, right around 2000, 2001.
Yeah.
DVD really exploded in the home market in 2000.
Right. Exactly.
That's one of the reasons, for instance, the PlayStation 2
exactly.
Sold so well, because it was a very affordable DVD player.
Right.
Where if you bought a standalone DVD player, it's about the same cost.
Exactly.
So parents were going, well, we want a DVD player, and this is also
exactly.
a video game system.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know if people realize that with the Blu-ray, but, you know, it's the same thing where,
yep.
you know, a lot of people, they still have the PlayStation, and then they still have a Blu-ray player. Yes,
mm-hmm.
it's a – but anyway, so going back to there, so that's what I did. I worked for him, and, you know, he was busy every weekend, so – you know, I did that and did that through, 2002 is where I realized, you know, instead of working for somebody else, I could do this for myself. And obviously, things have changed from the time I started in, it was the fall of 96, you know, through that 2002 where Final Cut Pro came out.
Yep.
And
and computers were starting to get more affordable.
They were affordable. Yeah. My first computer that I bought was a G4 400.
Mm-hmm.
Probably I might have paid $1,300-$1,400.
Yeah, for the grayscale, the gray color one.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was a great FireWire 400 built in.
And
see, that's the key right there. And a lot of people,
right.
I think, when they're talking about the history of film and editing, miss that. It really was FireWire 400 and affordable storage.
Exactly.
Those are the two things that kind of came together in the early 2000s that really propelled what we have today in video production. That was it. Nonlinear. Yeah. Video editing, for those who don't know what that means, is it's not a tape. It's just a file, and you can cut it up and do everything, and you still have the original.
Exactly. Non-destructive.
Yes. Oh, it was freedom. I remember when I first played with, it was an iMovie, the first time I played with it.
Exactly. That was I did.
Yeah. And I think that was a lot of people's kind of entry into, you know, that first hit of crack cocaine.
Right.
Look what I can do with a video.
Right.
I mean, it was unheard of for mere mortals to do anything with video. And here you are with all of this experience, this new technology comes out, and you jump on it really early.
Yeah. And that was good. And that's what, you know, I think kids should do that, you know, get as much hands-on experience as you can. And that's what I did in the linear days at the TV station. I mean, I was always there. You know, willing to learn, willing to get my hands dirty, willing to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, it's like, you know, because that's how you're going to learn.
I bet you still remember the guys who were showing you the ropes when you first got there.
Somewhat. There were a lot of guys showed me the ropes, but a lot of it I did initiate on my own.
Did
just
you?
Yeah. Yeah. And that helped too, because it was.
Well, that shows your work ethic as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which, let's not gloss over that. I mean, you're not going to be successful. I don't care what field you're in. If you don't have that work ethic,
exactly.
It's 5 o'clock, time to go home, but the project's not done. Well, no, I'm going never. Home. You know,
I still consider myself open 24 hours.
We have to.
Exactly.
Well, nowadays, I mean, you literally own your own business.
Right.
You really don't get days off. Exactly. You can't afford to get sick and just call in and somebody else will pick up the slack. No, it's you. You got to do it.
Right. Right.
So you started your own business.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a scary leap for you? I mean, up to that point, you worked for other people.
It was very scary. Now, what was good is from all those years that I did those events, that I did have a client base, although when I did leave to go on my own, it wasn't, you know, I never contacted those clients.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't step on anybody's toes, but through the grapevine, you know, the clients found out that I started my own company.
That's the way it always works.
Yeah, and at the same time, a lot of people in that business did the same thing where they were working for somebody and started their own. And obviously, it was a huge, huge, huge market. So same thing, you know, working every weekend. So it did take about 6 months to you know, really launch myself, and you know, it's still, you know, I still wasn't working every weekend after that 6 months, but you know, it probably took a good year where I was finally working every weekend, and then it tanked in at the beginning of 2009, and so you know, it's, you know, same thing. It's a combination of the economy and competition where, you know, anybody could go out and buy a camera. And unfortunately, in that event business, there were a lot of non-educated, non-technical
people. Yeah, non-skilled.
Very non-skilled where, you know, they knew that they could pick up a camera and, you know, make a profit of it. And, you know, the clients were really naive where, you know, they were happy just to see a picture on a screen versus the quality and all that. And that's what set me apart from my competition where, you know, I had the quality and the skill set, you know, of a broadcaster versus, you know, I say compared to something you'd see on cable access or, you know, even your home movie. So,
but that's an intangible that's very hard to sell when the guy next door is doing it for half the price.
Exactly. And I still kept my prices, you know, fairly reasonable. So, you know, I wasn't one of those, I'm really skilled and, you know, you're not going to pay any lower than $3,000. You know, I kept my prices, you know, probably in that, you know, $1,200 to $1,600 range just to compete with those other people. And, but I said it, you know, I made my money and then, invested in, high definition equipment in 2008. I went with the P2 format. Before that, I was working with DVCam, and I've always been a shoulder mount camera guy versus the handheld camcorder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that's where I use the news, and that's what I'm most comfortable with. So I did that, and fortunately, 2008 was had a really, really good year. I was contacted by Major League Baseball to be their freelance videographer for the Midwest. And
that's a tough gig, having to go to ballparks all the time.
And what's nice is during the game itself, the broadcasters have 100% of the rights. So there's nothing you can do during the ball game itself. So it's either pregame or postgame that you're working. So it is nice. So it's got to work with some really good people, and to this day I'm still good friends with them, and from ball players to producers and reporters. So it was really good. Unfortunately, at the end of the 2008 season, Major League Baseball decided to start the Major League MLB Network.
Yep.
It's great for them, but what they did is fired all the freelance people, but they installed ballpark cameras in every single ballpark. So, yeah, they spent money on this, but, and all the cameras are robotically controlled from a location in New York City. So there goes, the freelance job for them. So, But it still, led to other stuff. And,
it's also nice on the resume, too.
Well, definitely. Definitely nice on the resume where, it's that led me to so many other things. So in addition to, my own production company, which I had corporate clients, and you do a lot of on-site editing, a lot of for example, we had a lot of pharmaceutical clients who would take their top salespeople and take them on reward trips, and so I do an on-site shoot and edit where just show their various team building activities.
Sure.
Or they call breakout sessions where they're learning different skill sets and stuff. So you shoot a little behind the scenes of that, and you put together this 3 to 5 minute high energy video that shows them having fun and all that. And it did probably 4 or 5 a year.
And those pay good.
They pay very good. They put you in the top hotels in the world, in the country, and all that. So fortunately, I've been able to travel all over. Some of the places I've been to, Istanbul, that was one. Go to the Bahamas, San Diego, Vail, Colorado.
You got to suffer for your craft,
Exactly. So, and there are certain times where, you're stuck in the hotel room for a day or two, but then, they let you out at night, and you're not stuck there editing the whole time. So there are definitely perks and very nice rewards that come with it. So
the economy pretty much tanks for you and for a lot of people in 2009,
right.
And that kind of lasts for a couple years. A lot of companies are not spending money. Individuals are tightening their belt. Maybe they don't need such high quality production value for their wedding.
right?
Or, you know, this, a lot of companies are just not going to spend the money on
exactly, yeah,
something that doesn't contribute directly to the bottom line.
Correct. Yeah, they used to have unlimited budgets, and then literally they either slash their budgets completely, or, you know, were only spending thousands versus hundreds of thousands.
Right.
And so, you know, you found little gigs here and there. So, and you know that your daily rate used to be about $1,250 to $1,500, and then those daily rates went down from, you know, all the way down to $250 to $450 to $750 a day.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, you'd have this gig that paid $750 a day, if that one that came up for $250 a day came up, you took it because, you know,
it's money in the pocket.
It was money in the pocket, and, you know, that was...
And it could be a referral later.
Exactly.
It could be repeat business. You never know.
Exactly. And that's, you know, a lot of mine is networking and referral. I missed one NAB since 1998. And that was the time I went to Istanbul, and literally from the times that I go to NAB, it's like I've networked with these, you know, corporations with colleagues, and, you know, to this day we still keep in contact. So, it's a really great experience and great networking and
I went to my first NAB this year. I'll be there again next year. And it's if you're, and I'm talking to the audience, if you're into video production at all or anything to do with production, NAB is a show you really do need to go to. I mean, it's the show. It's the one that you have to go to. It's amazing. And you're going to be, by going there, you're going to be more informed on the technologies that are just coming out.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very informative. It can be overwhelming for some, but what you really have to do is pace yourself. Look at the different sessions that are available on the floor, and, you know, mark it down on your calendar. Say, yep, you know, from this time to this time, I want to do this. Otherwise, you know, you're walking into a candy store that you will get lost in. And in addition to just the NAB Expo floor, Future Media Concepts puts on Post-Production World, which they, you know, it's so worth, for students especially, it's very affordable, or anybody in the production world, you will learn, there's so many different tracks.
And that's the other aspect of what you do.
Oh, definitely.
Is that you never stop learning.
Never. I never stop learning.
And that makes the job more interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I get calls all times of the day. People, you know, I saw this post on the internet, blah, 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 and you answered the question, and I'm having this problem, so, you know, I'm asking for your advice. So I get calls, I get emails, and at one point I used to be on the Final Cut Pro forum in Creative Cal. And to go back, I used Final Cut Pro from the very, very beginning up until they went with Final Cut 10, which, you know, mm-hmm, threw the whole industry for a loop. But
yeah, I think Apple lost a lot
exactly,
of business on that.
They did, but they did it for their reasons.
Yep.
And so, you know, I literally learned Final Cut 7 from day one, and so I think on the Creative Cal forum, I'm considered like in the Hall of Fame for for like posting and answering questions. So,
what made you like to help others?
Just
because remember,
back.
Some of these people are your competition.
Exactly, a lot of them are my competition, and those that I know that are my competition, I won't tell them because I'll let
them. That's your competition, absolutely.
Exactly, that's my competition.
But it's good karma, yeah.
No, big karma. So, but you know, a lot of them internationally and nationally, I ran into these problems myself. But the way that I solved the problems was, you know, people, how do you do it? It's, you know, learning from the mistakes and the timeline, and, you know, learning the shortcuts and everything from the software, and, you know, literally self-teaching myself and, you know, the right ways and how not to do the wrong ways where you learn bad habits, and that could really, really slow you down in the edit suite. And, you know, I've always been a firm believer that time is money, and the quicker you get these things, you know, turned around, you know, you start your next project. So it's, you know, an ongoing learning and, you know, big experience out there. So it's, that's where I.
So we have the downturn in the economy.
Uh-huh.
Your business is in trouble.
Right.
How do you get from there to where you are now?
You ride the wave. I call it riding the wave. It's being patient. You know, your stress level goes up and, you know, thinking about, you know, when that next job is coming. You know it's coming. You don't know when, but it literally is. It's riding that wave. And, you know, no one can predict the future. And, you know, I've had colleagues that during that downturn, they had the best years of their life. And it's, you know, they found that one or two clients that was willing to take the risk and spend the money. Yet, you know, the clients that I had, you know, really, you know, slamming on their brakes. So, you know, you struggle with it, but, you know, try to maintain a positive attitude. And you know, like I said, it's riding that wave to, you know, and, you know, the unfortunate part is, yeah, you have a couple good months and then a lot of bad months. And, you know,
you have to preserve.
You do have to preserve, and which is good. I had a backup bank account, which really helped.
And that's something that a lot of people could probably learn from right there.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
I mean, when you work for yourself, you have to have that safety blanket.
That reserve, yeah. No, definitely. So, you know, obviously those good years I had, I had opened up what, you know, the virtual bank, which at the time was ING, which now I think it's Capital One 360.
Yep.
But, you know, in essence, what I did, I just automatically had payments coming out of my business account into this savings account. And, you know, to this day, I still have it. But that's, so, you know, in essence, I never saw that money until I needed it.
Right.
Until I need it.
You pretend that it's not even there. You know, right. That's not there. That's the just in case. Right. It's kind of like insurance. It's just in case.
Yeah. I've definitely had to dip into that. So, but at least it, you know, wasn't like, you know, like I had more than a few years reserved.
Yeah.
So
that's good.
Definitely, you know, there was a lot in there, and, you know, slowly as, you know, those bad months come, you gotta, you know, feel bad, you know, having to transfer that money back into my business account. But I definitely had to do that. And, cause you gotta pay the bills.
Yep.
And so, and I've always been the one to keep up with technology. So, you know, even though, you know, I had great cameras and great software and great this, I kept on buying. That Otherworld Computing has really, really, really good products.
I'm glad to hear that. you were actually, unlike most people, you were at OWC just a couple weeks ago.
Correct.
I wasn't there to meet you, by the way.
Sure.
But so, for those who've never been to OWC, could you kind of describe what it's like there? Because it's kind of surprising to a lot of people, especially the big. I want to say windmill, but
right.
You know, wow, why am I drawing a blank on that?
But the energy, what do they call those? Energy wind?
Wind turbine. Jeez,
wind turbines.
Yeah. My mind just went blank.
Sure.
But in my defense, for those listening right now, I'm actually recording the show a lot later in the day than I usually do.
Actually, my mind works better later in the day than early in the day.
I used to be that way, but I think when
kids,
the
kids will do that.
Yes.
Right?
they suck the energy right out of you.
They do. But actually, at OWC, I haven't gotten a full tour yet. I've only been in like just that opening area. So I haven't gotten a full tour of the facility.
We'll have to rectify that.
But definitely, definitely. But no, it's, you know, it's actually, I remember, God, it's got to be 5, 6, could be 7 or more years ago when they were in like a little shack in Woodstock. And I went there to pick up, it must have been like a DVD drive or something like that, or, you know, something really small. And, you know, it's for me, I think what they're like 20 something miles away, but it's, but there's two different ways that I could go. I can go a tollway and then like
the backcountry road.
And then the backcountry road.
I've done the drive both ways.
Yeah, and for me, my Waze tells me it's the same amount of time. So it's nice. The backcountry roads it's a nice.
Well, it depends on the time of the day.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're trying to drive up at you know 4 o'clock,
right? No, you get stuck in traffic.
Yeah, you don't want.
Not in the Chicagoland area.
No.
You
know. And where I live and where OWC is, it's about in really nice weather, it's about a 4 or 4.5 hour drive.
Wow.
But I have to plan it carefully because if I leave my home too late in the morning, like 6 o'clock, I'm going to hit the rush hour traffic, and that 4, 4.5 hour drive is now a 6-hour drive.
Exactly.
And the same thing coming back. So, yeah. But, yeah, it's seeing that wind turbine and realizing here's a company that you remember, in your words, a shack. I wasn't with OWC, so I don't know what that facility looked like.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it was a smaller company then.
Right? Oh, smaller. And yeah. That was nice where, you know, they were able to get newer technology in there and a few others. And you know, it's definitely grown. Larry definitely did a very good job.
He knows what he's doing, doesn't he?
He definitely knows what he's doing. I wish I had his brains. I mean, like I said, we'll go back to that education where I guess brains does help.
Oh, absolutely.
In certain ways, but
it's inspirational when you see what he's done.
Right, right.
And you've been around as a customer long enough to have seen that transition.
Yeah, like I said, my G4400, you know, I bought my RAM from OWC.
Full disclosure, so did I. I remember my G4 I bought from OWC as a customer, G4 processor upgrade for mine. And, oh, it was so cool. I bought that, right. And a couple weeks, maybe a couple months later, I bought more RAM, and then I bought a hard drive, everything from OWC. Right. So before I was an employee, I was a customer, right?
Exactly. You know?
And so that's one of the reasons that I'm happy to work for this company because I was a customer first. I know the products well. I know the company well. I've met Larry a number of times. I did interviews with him for other shows before I was with OWC Radio. And so I also kind of saw the company growing, but that's different than you because I never was in the Chicagoland area to physically see it.
Right, right.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. So we tried to do this interview last week. And that's why the shows, we skipped a week because I didn't want to just have a filler show. I wanted to do this with you for this whole episode. And we tried to do it over Skype, and you were using your iPhone as a mobile hotspot. Explain where you were.
I was in Akron, Ohio, shooting a documentary on the Soapbox Derby. And the name of the documentary is The Thousand Feet Project, and to keep it simple, it's taking these underprivileged kids in New York City and teaching them how to build and drive these Soapbox Derby cars. And we were almost starting for the day, and but we had other, you know, two other camera guys who were out there shooting, and so obviously we're in the middle of Ohio trying to get a wireless connection, and
it worked a little bit,
but it wasn't flawless.
No,
and that's so it's good that we could that our viewers out there can hear us clearly versus hearing us.
Yeah, it was pretty bad, but we gave it a try.
We tried. You know, we tried.
I have said many times in the past there are no rules in podcasting.
Sure.
I actually did a lot more of that kind of thing with the original OWC Radio back in 2009 and 10 where I would literally take a portable recording device and go for a walk by a stream, and the listeners could actually hear the stream in the background. Uh-huh. And I thought that was cool. I do almost everything this way now because I really like these conversations with people, and that's kind of hard to do with a portable recording gig out on the road. But even though there's no rules, you still have to have decent audio. Nobody wants to listen to complete dropouts and me repeating the question and then you sitting there quietly because you never even heard me because of the dropout. So I appreciate you coming on a week later to do it because I was looking forward to talking to you.
Yeah.
So the 1,000 Feet Project, how did you get involved in that?
A good friend of mine who's the director is based out of New York, and how I got connected with him, I was in New York for a sports video convention, and he was attending
going back to your MLB days?
Somewhat. This was 2010, I guess.
No, but I mean, it's because of your involvement with MLB.
The sports video?
Yeah.
Somewhat. I've always been intrigued with sports, sports production. I've always, when I worked at the TV station, I did a lot of sports, and so I've always, and I freelance for a lot of the whether it's Fox Sports, Turner, all that stuff. So,
sports is, from a production standpoint, it's a different story every night.
Oh, big time.
You have no idea what the story is going to be. And then there's going to be the stories within the stories. Oh, this player was suspended because of Inflategate. And this guy got hurt during the thing. And this guy's traded. There's always something with sports. I mean, it's kind of each event's almost a mini documentary in itself.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, I was athletic growing up. So I played the sports. So. Being involved in the production is so fun. And so, the sports video group is the conference they have that every year in New York. And same thing, it's another networking opportunity. Mm-hmm. All the presidents of the, whether it's CBS, Fox, NBC, all that, they're all there. All the executive producers, anybody and anybody that's in that production,
they're going to be there.
So,
and you're not going to get that business if you're sitting at home.
Not at all. So, unfortunately, my father lives out in New York City. So,
that'll make it cheaper.
So that, I just pay for airfare and I have a place to stay because, those New York hotels are outrageous. So, a friend of mine was taking a multicam class taught by Mitch Jacobson, who's like a multicam guru, and Mitch is a good friend of mine. And I had stopped by the, because I got in town and know he was putting on the show, which I helped him out when he did the show in Chicago. So, showed up to his event in New York and met this guy, Chris, and, it was, instantly bonded. He saw, my inspirational thoughts and video production, and he attached to me real quick, and we've been friends ever since. And so Chris started the nonprofit last year when same thing, he wanted to give back. Mm-hmm. something to give back. So he found a way to raise money to so these kids can afford to build these cars, and obviously starting any nonprofit or any type of charity, it's rough in the beginning, and it takes a while to finally raise these funds. And he never met his personal goal, but did make enough to at least get the project off the ground. And he himself is a USC grad, film school grad. And
so he understood the power of.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he got two of the other DPs on the project are USC grads, and he got their colleagues to get involved with the whole project. And, we're making the what they call the minimal union rate, whatever that is. So. So we're making something, and definitely we'll probably make it back in the back end once the whole project is complete. And, you know, we're giving us ourselves another year where a lot of people, you know, just love to go out and shoot, put this thing together, and then, all right, let's throw it at the festival.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how long is this just, project going to take to film and edit and have a completed movie?
Exactly. And I think, you know, we're not rushing. We're not definitely not rushing. We want to put a goal, you know, like next year as a, you know, completion date. And, you know, even though everything's great with the kids and the cars, there's some controversy with the personal people that are behind the scenes that are like.
And there's your story.
Well, it's there's definitely a story in there, and then we did get to a point on literally late Sunday night that Chris got a phone call from one of the guys back in New York who should have been in Akron, Ohio to really experience what was going on, and you know he heard some stuff that was going on. Everything's positive. Except this guy back in New York feels that he should have gotten some recognition or something like that. And so he's jealous and all that. And so, you know, he started slamming, you know, Chris and the whole documentary project and this and that. And so obviously, we definitely have to decide. And obviously, you know, documentaries or any type of movie controversy, you know, really makes a story. So
absolutely.
But a lot of this is, you know, a lot of slander, a lot of, you know, negative publicity. So, you know, we just have to decide, you know, are we going to include it in the documentary or are we just going to cut them off completely? So, you know, it's like everything else is such a positive experience.
Well, you know, you got to have a protagonist and an antagonist in a good story.
Exactly. So, you know, we'll see how things develop.
Is this the first documentary you've worked on?
I've worked on a bunch of documentaries.
Really?
So,
what's the most well-known that people would go, oh, yeah, I've seen that, or I've heard of that at least?
Well, there's some still in the works. One of them was a few years ago. I did a documentary on Jewish baseball players.
Oh.
And what it was is... a colleague from Chicago came up with this concept to have a print made of Jewish baseball players, and through you know trials and errors and all this, you know he finally got it off the ground, and so he had a professional artist who's done tons of sports stuff create this huge canvas print. And it included 28 ball players, and then in the crowd there's a bunch of executives and actors and personalities in there. And what we did is went around the country to have these the print signed. So in addition to an original canvas, he had 500 or total of 500, but there were 300 prints of the canvas and 200 prints of a canvas.
Wow.
So there's a canvas print and a like a poster print of it. And so there's five different series. So like the first series of 100 is just the ball player signing it. The second one is the ball players and the crowd member signing it.
So where's the documentary part of that?
So the documentary, how this came about was, the guy, his name is Greg. He's like, Steve, you know, our first signing's in Milwaukee. You know, I just want you to get some footage of it, you know, and then, you know, we'll put it on the website to publicize the print. During that first signing, we didn't realize how labor intensive it is to get these prints signed.
Yeah.
So that's how the documentary came into development. So you know we had like a huge assembly line because like each you know it was just one player signing, but then since it was the first signing, each print had to be authenticated by MLB, which you know they're there. So you in addition, you have an authenticator, and then you have another person who's making sure that the authentication is real. And then, you know, like I said, we have, you know, 500 prints that we have to, you know, keep moving. And so he signs a print, moves to the next one, signs it, moves it. But then, you know, you got the authenticator too. And, you know, we didn't, this is the first signing, so we didn't know if you stack the prints on top of each other, if the ink will smear and stuff. So we use Sharpie pens and all that. And so, it took a really long time for this process, and we didn't have a whole lot of space to work with. So, like a few days later, the next signing was supposed to be in Florida, and we had two separate signings, one in Tampa with five guys, and then one in Jupiter, Florida with like five or six guys. And we're like, God, if, you know, we barely struggled, you know, with one guy, how are we going to do with all this? So, you know, it's like, so we, you know, put our brainstorming together, and we got people to help out with the signings. And obviously, you know, they said, you know, this is a matter of, you know, shooting a couple minutes worth of footage and, you know, posting on YouTube. We figured, we can make a real documentary out of this.
Yeah, so you could tell a story.
So that, you know, obviously we did, you know, we had a, you know, signings in Florida and Los Angeles and Philadelphia, Arizona. And, you know, and then after we did all the signings, we did a sit down interview with the creator of the project, who really told the story of the whole process, literally from his first idea of coming up with the idea to have this print made to the final final, you know, signing of it and all that. And, you know, it's a little over an hour long, and, you know, he launched the project a couple years ago. And, So the prints are for sale, and so along with the print, you get the DVD, and, you know, there's a booklet that has.
So it's not just a print; it's a whole package.
Oh, it's a whole package,
and that's really cool.
And obviously, the names that are on this print, so it's from Sandy Koufax to, it's just there's so many, you know, just Sandy Koufax alone. You know, his signature is worth so much.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, and it's really geared toward, you know, the collectors. And obviously, you know, since they're all Jewish, you know, mainly a Jewish audience who have, you know, a lot of, you know, strong baseball roots and stuff like that. So, so those guys, you know, they've been following these guys from, you know, from the, and there's players on there from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, all the way to the current players. And so,
awesome.
So, you know, it's definitely a marquee piece that, you know, it's getting a lot of attention now from just different Jewish community centers.
Well, it's baseball too. I mean, it almost transcends just the Jewish aspect. I mean, exactly. Baseball fans are baseball fans.
Yeah.
I mean, Sandy Koufax alone, I mean, that's right. A big deal.
Right.
Now, right before we started recording, I gave you a warning.
Uh-huh.
And we're getting long, so we should probably get to these, because I love this at this time of the show. These are the three dreaded random questions. I prepare these questions ahead of time.
I'm so not good at these.
And these are not questions that I made or that I found for you in particular. Uh-huh. They're just questions. You get the next three. So are you ready?
I'm ready for anything. I'm not good at these, but I'm ready.
First one. Would you survive a zombie apocalypse?
A zombie apocalypse. A zombie. I definitely would. I'm a survivor, so I'll do whatever it takes to. And since I get along with everyone, these zombies would be my best friends.
All right, next one. I think I know the answer to this one.
Okay.
Are you either sunrise, daylight, twilight, or night?
Twilight.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
I'm a twilighter. I mean, I will be able to get up in early in the morning if I know I have a job or whatever. You know, my mind's in that. Like I said, I have a great worth ethic. You know, I'm there 120% no matter what. But my mind is the most creative. It is so creative in those twilight hours because the phone's not ringing. You don't have those distractions. And it's just your mind is free for any idea.
You know, I know I said I'm a morning person, and that's kind of an outgrowth of work and kids and school and getting to the bus stop and all that. But, you know, on the side, I am attempting to write a book. I had one of my favorite authors on OWC Radio a few months ago named T.R. Harris, and we've stayed friends and in communication since he's been on the show. And he knew that I was trying to write a book. And it's because of his guidance and help that I've actually progressed. I'm like 16,000 words into this now. Mm-hmm. But the only time I write
is twice.
Once the kids are in bed.
Exactly.
I put on some headphones. I put on a certain playlist. And the creativity flows. I don't think I could do it in the morning.
Yeah. And same thing. Like people, I work out of my apartment. People are like, how do you do that? You know, I got to get out of the house in order. It's like, this is my comfort zone.
Yeah.
It's the same way. It's like, you know, doing this is, and a lot of it is, why should I get a place where I have to pay rent?
And plus, most of the time, you're on the road. Your job is you go out and film, and then you have to come back to somewhere to edit. Why not there?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's something that you can afford to do.
Exactly.
Why not do that?
Exactly.
And you don't have to cut the grass.
That's true.
Last of the random questions.
Okay.
At the beach, would you rather play in the sand or play in the water?
If the water is bath temperature, I would be in the water.
Yeah, you don't like the cold water.
I do not like cold weather. So, you know, Lake Michigan, forget it. But you put me in the Caribbean, I'd love it. Pacific Ocean is still cold.
I would assume that with this question, you have to assume it's a nice sunny day.
Exactly,
the water's nice. Everything being equal, you're in the water.
I'm in the water. Now, not to say that my birth sign is Pisces. So, you know, definitely I'm a water person. And believe it or not, in the early 70s, Mark Spitz was an inspiration for me watching the 72 Olympics. And, you know, I wanted to be that competitive swimmer and all that, but, you know, never made it to that point, but I was definitely a swimmer. So,
well, I would be in the water with you because if there's one thing I hate more than anything, that's not like a bug biting me or something, it's sand. I hate, I don't know why I have a disdain for sand. It gets everywhere.
It's everywhere.
I hate it. And it's hot. You blister your feet. And ugh, I hate it. There used to be a beach close to my house that had grass right to the edge of the water. And, oh, I loved it. They turned it into a great big beach with all the sand and all that now. But back in the day, the Army and the Air Force used to use that lake as a munitions dump. So there was old tanks and jeeps and everything in the water. Probably wasn't safe to swim in, but what the heck, I did. But I remember going out deep, and you could feel metal if you went down deep enough. So they dredged it. It's a great lake now, but for me, it ruined it because I like the feel of grass on my feet. I hate sand, so I'd be in the water with you. Steve. So Steve Eisen, where can people learn more information about you? Or if, you know, they are in the market for someone who does what you do, where can they go and get that information?
My website is eisenvideo.com. That's E-I-S-E-N, like the president, video.com. The website's not, you know, it's outdated, but you could still reach me there.
Great. Are you on Twitter or Facebook or any of that?
I have all that. Same thing. I think my Twitter handle's eisenvideo. So Facebook, I'm around. So all those, Instagram. So
I will find the links and I will put them in the show notes for OWC Radio number 46. Before we wrap up here, I do want to remind people, if you're looking to upgrade your Mac, Mac Sales is the place to go. MacSales.com. Otherworld Computing has hard drives. If you've got a conventional hard drive in your computer, go to OWC, look at an SSD. Steve, I can't use a computer without an SSD anymore.
Exactly. That's like my. I'm sitting here in front of my laptop now. I have the upgraded that to the 1.5 terabyte as my main hard drive. Mm-hmm. I have the. I took the DVD drive out. I have the OWC doubler in there, mm-hmm. And I have a SSD in that one. My Mac Pro 2013 had the original 1 terabyte flash. I upgraded to OWC's 2 terabyte flash, so I'm happy.
the difference between
time is money.
It's so painful. Even if you don't make your money on your computer, everything is so much faster with an SSD. Launching an app, websites, your photos library. Ugh, it's just there's no comparison. So if you guys are not with the SSD program,
you're missing out.
I would say this whether I'm on OWC radio or a cooking show.
OWC doesn't pay me; I pay them. Believe me, they pay me; I pay them.
So make sure you go in there if you need any of your equipment upgraded or you need some external storage. If you want to find out the sales that are going on, make sure you're following us on Twitter. It's at Mac Sales. And, of course, we are on Facebook, OWC Mac Sales. And make sure you check out our blog. That's really where we're posting the latest happenings of what OWC is doing. I get a lot of, because I'm currently doing the social media, although we're going to be bringing someone else in to do it here real soon. I'm currently doing the social media OWC. And I see a lot of you asking about certain Macs and an SSD upgrade. I get this question on social media. We get this question on social media, I don't want to say every day, but almost every day. I'm not going to say which Macs it is, but I will say this fall you're going to be very happy. So I'll let people read between the lines on that. I'm not announcing anything. I'm just saying this fall you're going to be a happy camper. Steve, thanks very much for being on OWC Radio this week. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.